The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
One of the things I used to love about my father was that he would bring home tales of being out with people who weren't very much like my family. My family was a very bright and funny, kind of quick-witted group of people. Although my parents never went to college or university, they read a lot and knew a lot about music and art, and we used to enjoy having private jokes with each other. And it was a very heady environment to grow up in. When my father was a working man, and he ran a fruit and vegetable store, and he would come home talking about the things that people said at the fruit and vegetable market early in the morning, and all through the day, the customers who'd come in, and the people who worked in the store, and he was a person who you might say did not suffer fools gladly. An old expression that means that he wasn't that patient with people who weren't that bright, and it was something that that we would laugh about at the expense of others. And as I got older, I was sort of upset by it. I thought, well, he needs to be nicer to people. But every once in a while, I remember his voice saying things, quoting other people, and I realized this morning one of the things that he used to say quite often was resonating in my head, and I realized the compassion underlying it, because he was genuinely amused by the way people were. He might sound like he was mocking them, but there was a delight that he took in the things people say. It's like that old television show, Art Linkletter used to, kids say the darndest things, or whoever that was, I can't remember who it was, but like human beings say the darndest things. But one of the things he used to love, on a hot summer day, he'd come back and we'd be sitting at dinner and he'd say, you know what somebody said to me today? They said, hot enough for you? And on a cold winter day, they'd say, cold enough for you? And he just thought that was the funniest thing that anybody could ever say. He would laugh and we'd all join him in laughing. So it's kind of double-edged sword in a way. Mockery, sarcasm maybe, but also appreciation, some kind of a, can you believe that somebody said to me today, cold enough for you? What's the response to that? We would talk about, what do you say when somebody says that? And we would ask my dad, what do you say to people? And he would say, I just say, yep. And then now I think too, wow, another demonstration, right, of just acknowledging, you know, even though inside him he went, what? Why would you ask that question? In response, he would smile and nod and say, yep. And the thing was that he was a beloved person at the fruit and vegetable market, and his little shop was swarmed with customers, and people just loved him. They adored him. And I think his safety valve was coming home to his well-trained family who would laugh at his jokes. And when we were well-trained. So I was thinking, of course, naturally about that today. The weather. Another thing people would say is, how about the weather? You know, cold enough for you? Icy enough for you? Did you get enough snow? All these things. Like, what else can you say but, yep, yes, mm-hmm. Yeah, quite sufficient, thank you. So we're supposed to be heading into well below zero tonight. Well below zero Fahrenheit, for those of you from foreign countries where you measure things in Celsius. That's really, really cold. And not only that, with a wind chill factor that's down in the high negative 30s, which is the kind of thing where that we don't get that weather very much here. The cold itself, the actual temperature, and then the wind making it even colder. For the last many, many hours, it's been snowing and then sleeting, and it'll continue doing that off and on for the next few hours, apparently, if you believe in meteorology, a really interesting science of prediction. And so here we are, just us sitting here, just us in the warmth and brightness. The lights are still working and the furnace is running, and the snowblower worked this morning, and the shovels, which are not dependent on batteries or electricity but on bodhicitta energy from people wielding them, also worked. And we're so lucky. We're so blessed. It is indeed cold enough for us. It is indeed snowy enough, icy enough for us. It's just right. There couldn't be anything better than this. And yet, the mind compares and maybe says, oh, I wish it was warmer, or oh, I don't like ice. Ice isn't good. I don't like that. I want just snow. Snow would be good. Light, fluffy. Or couldn't it just be a little warmer and it all turned to rain and wash away? Whatever is in our minds, and you know, those are just some of the things I think, they don't do justice to that great koan of the fruit and vegetable market. Cold enough for you. It is indeed just right, but we don't see that. So this morning, investigating Lojong teachings a little bit, I want to lightly touch on them and then return to the koan of cold enough for you. We could also say sick enough for you. It's just such a funny thing to say. Yeah, it is just perfect, right? Just the right amount of sickness. I certainly didn't think that this morning. I thought I was getting better and I'd be all better, and then, oh, a little downturn, and now I'm better again, and, you know, this is going to keep happening for the rest of my life. There's no way to avoid it, and we all know this. So in our point six, which we're investigating the discipline of relationship, and the discipline of training the mind, as Trungpa Rinpoche refers to it, we have a whole bunch of things that are, we might call them no-brainers. They're very much related to ethical behavior in the world. They're not very subtle. They're not hard to understand. Any human being who's been with other human beings knows that these things are probably good ideas. So starting with number 31, don't malign others. Don't criticize others. Don't put people down. That makes sense. And then the next one, don't wait in ambush. This is a slightly more interesting one to me, because when we learn about people, when we get to know each other intimately, we sometimes see where our weaknesses and wounds are. And don't wait in ambush essentially means don't hang around waiting for an opportunity to get somebody. This is such a way that human beings interact with each other on a regular basis, just always trying to put each other down and find the weakness, find the soft spot, and come in for the attack. As I was saying last night, you know, the person who was the scientist who collected the data points about me knew me really well, and so she had been, in a sense, waiting in ambush. According to the Lojong teachings, one of the worst things you can do, because of course it doesn't honor that everyone is a suffering human being, and everyone equally has the bodhicitta, the great energy of awakening. And then the next one is, don't make everything so painful. And this is a teaching that goes all the way back to the original teachings of Shakyamuni Buddha, when he talks about suffering and how suffering is like a fire unbound, and we don't want to keep adding logs to it. We want to spread the logs around, get more spacious, find the space between the logs so that the fire can eventually die out. But we tend to keep putting more logs on the fire, so we are always making things more painful. So not maligning, not criticizing others, not waiting in ambush, not waiting for our opportunity to get back. And that also is connected to not seeking revenge, which was another one earlier. And don't make everything so painful. Come on, it's hard enough, right? Why do we have to just keep adding fuel to the fire? And then the next one is the one that I want to look into a little more deeply and use our koan tradition to get even underneath it, way deeper than where even I was thinking about when I first was reading about these teachings. I got inspired by a koan that just came to mind, and I thought, huh, what is this koan trying to show me about this Lojong slogan? So I want to share what I discovered with you. And the slogan in Norman Fisher's translation is, don't unload on everyone. And again, that as a, just an ethical behavior, that's a no-brainer. You know, just don't dump on others. Don't take our own difficulties and put them on others. Norman Fisher talks about the wonderful Zen saying, don't put a head on top of your own head. Don't make extra. It's very much related to don't make everything so painful. Don't just add insult to injury, as we like to say in English. But in the original slogans that from the Tibetan, this goes like this: don't transfer the ox's load to the cow. So don't take what is meant for the ox and transfer it to the cow. And in the ordinary way of understanding this, some things are too much for some people. So in our kindness and clarity, when we're giving instructions, we don't give you more than you can handle, hopefully, maybe just enough. And then you might think, you know, you've been practicing for years and suddenly you get an instruction that you didn't know about, but maybe one of us didn't think up until this point that you could bear it. It would just be too much to be reminded about bowing or the way you hold a bell or anything like that. We try to be sufficient but not overwhelm each other. And so in the conventional sense, that's what this means. Don't transfer the ox's load to the cow. Don't give the cow, which is a much more fragile creature, what the ox is supposed to bear. But on a level of I think what Zen is pointing us to, what's the difference between the ox and the cow? There are many, many koans where the ox and the cow are compared to each other, or two students are compared to each other, and the teacher seems to be criticizing one student and praising another. This is a temptation to praise and blame. We maybe think, oh man, I am a cow. I want to be an ox. Burden me. Load me up. And we don't realize that cows and oxen are equal in capacity on the elemental level, that all of us, and because all of us are equally awakened creatures, we are equally full, suffused with, completely saturated with bodhicitta, with the awakened heart mind. There is no comparison. Every single creature, everything we encounter, is it. And the mind of comparison says, well, that couldn't be, because I know myself. I'm a poor excuse for a human being. Or, no, wait, I'm an ox. I deserve more. I'm the best there ever is. What all of you guys need to recognize how special and wonderful and important I am. So we have, we might say, delusions of being an ox and delusions of being a cow. And all comparisons will lead us into this trap of being deluded, of judging ourselves and others. This one's better, that one's worse. And the thing is, the great sage of the fruit and vegetable market knows how to see through all of this. It is, in fact, cold enough for you. It is, in fact, just enough. Just enough. Everything is sufficient. As we said in one of our chants today, nothing is lacking from the beginning. Nothing has been missing. Everything is just right as it is. Doesn't make sense because people get sick and people die and we get older and we have all kinds of problems and people say and do all kinds of nasty things. And so where's justice? Where's fairness? And on the level that I'm talking about, everything is as it is. Oxen and cows are equal. There's no comparison. So the koan that came to mind was one from The Gateless Gate. Many of you are probably familiar with it. And it's case number 26. And it goes like this. And I'll just read it and then give you a little background on it because I think it's important to know what happened to the speaker of the ultimate line before he came to understand that cows and oxen are the same. Case 26 is two monks roll up the bamboo blinds. And it goes like this. When the monks had gathered in the hall before the midday meal to hear Fa Yan Wen Yi, the master pointed to the bamboo blinds. At this, two monks went and rolled them up, both in the same manner. Fa Yan said, "One got it, one missed." And there you have it, right? One was an ox and one was a cow. One was a good Zen student and one was a bad one. This is the way our minds go, and Fa Yan is showing us our minds because Wu Men, the collector of the koan, is very clear. He says they rolled up the blinds in the same manner. That is exactly the same. They were equal. Yasutani Roshi, in his comment on this koan, his comments points out the earlier moment in the koan when the master points to the bamboo blinds and says, "Don't miss that moment either." That pointing. That, of course, is what Zen teachers are doing all the time. All we can do is point to ourselves and to others. Look, look. Don't ignore it. Here it is. This is the thing that you need to pay attention to. It's right here. Apparently blinds, apparently two different people, apparently rolling up the same, apparently gaining and losing, getting it and missing it. So I just want to give you a little background on this guy, Fa Yan, who became very, very famous. He lived towards the end of the Tang Dynasty, the beginning of the Sung. He overlapped two very different political climates in China in the 9th and 10th centuries. And when he was a young man, he wandered around from teacher to teacher. One of the things that modern Westerners can really relate to, what we sometimes call digging shallow holes expecting to get well water. A very common thing in those days as well as now, because there was so much available then, there's so much available now, so why not go everywhere? And he did that, and he finally ran into a teacher, and I didn't realize this when I was researching him a little bit, that the teacher he ran into when he was on pilgrimage, he had to take shelter from a storm. So we can imagine that all of us here have taken shelter from the great storm that's still raging around us outdoors, coming into the warmth and light of the temple. And he did the same thing. And the teacher there, Luohan, Gui Chen, asked him why he was on pilgrimage. Why are you wandering around, he said. And Fa Yan answered, "I don't know." Which is, I think, one of the most honest responses anyone can really answer. Although if you answer it formulaically, if you use "I don't know" as a formula, that's not honoring the reality of Fa Yan's sincerity. I don't know why I'm wandering around on pilgrimage. I don't know why I practice Zen. as we talked about in a Dharma dialogue a few days ago, why do we do this? I don't know. Why have you given up a part of your life to come and experience your life in the silence and stillness of this hall? Why? Why? And Fayan says, I don't know. And then Luohan replies to him, not knowing is the most intimate. And lest we believe that this story ends with, and then Fayan became enlightened, he didn't. That it turns out that according to the biography of Fayan, he acknowledged that and it stayed with him, but it didn't seem to do any good. He went off back on his endless pilgrimage. And he finally, he was about to leave, going back into the snowstorm, and he turned around and he asked a question of Luohan. He said, "Okay," and we got to realize now, Fayan is revealing himself beautifully. A scholar of Buddhism, a student of the way, someone who had gone from temple to temple, absorbing the great teachings of the masters of the late Tang Dynasty, he said, okay, so I've got a question for you. I want to know about the three realms and mind. Can you help me here? And the teacher said, you say that the three realms are nothing but mind, and all dharmas are nothing but consciousness. Now tell me, is the stone out there in the courtyard within your mind or outside your mind? An interesting question from the fellow who just said, not knowing is the most intimate. We might think that he is baiting Fayan at his the edge of his being open. So he asks them this question. Everything is within the mind. That's the teachings, right? That's what you just asked me about. And now I'm asking you, is that stone out there in the courtyard, the actual thing itself, is it in your mind or is it outside your mind? And Fayan said, it's within my mind, which is a very good answer. It's an answer that implies that he understands that everything is created by the mind. But it doesn't honor the reality of form. And so what happens next is famous, not only in Zen, but then many years later in Western philosophy, we get a similar exchange between two people, two 17th century philosophers. So when he says, within my mind, the teacher says, oh, you wanderer. Oh, you who wander. Oh, you who wander from temple to temple, not knowing the meaning of your pilgrimage. Oh, you wander. What makes it so necessary for you to travel with a stone in your mind? Yeah, right. And what does make it so necessary? So, we don't know what happened next in their dialogue, but what we do know is that Fayan stayed with this teacher until he himself came to his own awakening and stayed further and became a great master on his own. And he actually had many, many temples. He was kind of the James Ford of the early Sung Dynasty, and he became a national teacher, very big in the new government. They celebrated him in the Sung Dynasty as being some really wonderful guy who people would come to him and study with him and great learning, the national teacher of that moment. And so here we are then, many years later, sitting in his zendo, and he points to the bamboo blinds. I could just as easily point to the floor or to the snow falling. I could point to the heart of each one of you. I could point to your uniqueness as an ox or a cow. I could point to anything you like. What happens in that particular moment in time, that little historical moment, people must have talked about it forever. That's why koans became fixed. They're little bits of gossip that lodged in the minds of people that got carried from temple to temple and over hundreds of years got written down. And two really astute students, two people who wished to be oxen, jumped up to do what they thought was the master's bidding. Who knows what he wanted? He just was pointing. You know, it's kind of great, those of us who play the bells, and now there are a number of us in the room, and the more senior people will point, and we don't know what that means. Like, what am I supposed to do? Am I supposed to hit a bell now? Am I supposed to stop it? Am I supposed to not stop it? Am I supposed to lift something? What? Just pointing, maybe. the impossibility of knowing what gestures really mean. So he's just pointing, and I like to think he's pointing out the Dharma, as all teachers do, and as Fayen did on countless occasions. And yet these guys, you know, I want to do the right thing, and let's do it. And so this gives us a hint, maybe, of what happens next. They do the blind rolling in exactly the same manner. And Fayen says, one did it right and one did it wrong. One of you is an ox and one of you is a cow. The temptation there is to get lost in judgment. And this is what happens. Later when Wu Men collected this koan in his collection, The Gateless Gate, he talks about how one gains and one loses. And when the blind is all the way up, we see the clear blue sky. I believe that will happen within hours or at least days for us too. And I'm not just talking about the weather. There are moments when things clarify. And Wu Men says, that great sky, that great blue sky, even that is not as good as what we're doing. So there it is again, a comparison. You think it's wonderful to have awakening, to see the Buddha nature in everything, to understand everything. It's not enough. Even that doesn't come up to it. And we have our teachings from our great ancestor Lin Shi, just be ordinary. Just lie down when you're tired and eat when you're hungry. So simple, so straightforward. And yet, if we do that as a technique, as a strategy, we miss the mark too. All of these teachings come together into the great thing we call living. And there's truly, as Fayen knew even as a young student, no knowing. And then as he was prodded to see things are in the land of no knowing are so close that the barrier even drops away. And so he's carrying the stone in his mind. We're carrying all our criticisms, our self-judgments, our judgments of others, all of our strategies for coping with a world that is fairly random in what it brings forth for us. It only seems random because we can't know all the causes and conditions. We can't figure out the source of this storm that we're in the middle of right now. Outside the temple and maybe inside our own hearts, we can't get to the bottom of things as much as we try. And yet, the world is constantly offering itself to us and showing us the way. Is it cold enough for you? Getting to the bottom of everything means being fully present right now. Right here. Not knowing is the most intimate. Don't give what is yours to someone else is another way of understanding the slogan. Keep it close to your own heart. Study it as if it was the most important thing in the world. Because it is. Thank you. So you will know to make yourselves comfortable. And you all know that the talk is being recorded, so if you want it to be stopped for any reason, let us know that. And yeah, we'll go around and introduce ourselves. I'm Melissa.
Esther.
Jenny.
Say your name.
Judith. Susan.
Ray.
Carol.
Eric. And Alan.
Rick.
David.
So, questions, comments, it can be about the talk that I just gave, about anything coming up for you around practice.
So I'll just mention one little thing. Maybe it's not little that came up for me about, you know, the koan, one gains, one loses, or, you know, one did it right, one did it wrong. One function for me of a retreat like this is that I'm constantly finding myself doing things and thinking that there's a way to do them and that I'm doing them wrong, you know. And sometimes I know that I'm doing them wrong. It's like, oh, you know. And then sometimes I am oblivious and I get a message I'm doing them wrong. And sometimes I'm doing them right, but some circumstance arises such that I'm doing them wrong. And so it's easy for me to get into this idea of right way, wrong way, and start measuring myself against it. And so really, so what I love about the koan is they do it exactly the same way. And so it's, you know, and so there's something kind of freeing up there. Like, you know, maybe it's not so clear cut that there's this way to do it and that's the right way. And there's this other way, your way to do it, and that's the wrong way. So I'm not sure where I'm going with that, but it's very alive for me right now.
Yeah, that's great. Do you have any words of wisdom, Roshi?
No.
Yeah, I mean, I think the right and wrong approach gets us into right and wrong. And like, that's a trap. There are certain things that cause harm and certain things that help people. And so it's hard to know which is which. And if we're just trying, and this is where, you know, the list of things to remember. Like we talked about this in terms of the shuso job, you know, there's this thick manual to train you to be a shuso, and if you try to memorize it, it's got a list, and you know you keep it with you. Underneath that is an intention. When I was teaching people how to teach mindfulness, we used to talk about form and essence. So the form was, in class one, you're supposed to teach a body scan. The essence nature of that has to do with we begin introducing people to being present in their bodies because most people aren't present in their bodies. So sometimes back in the day, we wouldn't get to the body scan in the first class, and people who were trying to memorize the list got very upset because they hadn't checked off the box. They didn't do the body scan. You know, uh-oh. And they would... But something else had maybe it happened in that first class that had the same essence nature of allowing people to perceive what it felt like to be in the body. And so, you know, you see what I'm talking about? So yes, every single form in Zen has an essence nature beneath it. And it's really hard to understand that at first. So we just say, when the bell rings, bow. And then gradually, something starts happening and it becomes second nature. Then the form isn't that important. You know, you could play the bell this way or that way or this way, hit your head with it. You know, ding. Doesn't matter, right? But yeah. So I think you're onto something really, really important. Yeah, we'll never figure this out. We'll never learn all the forms. It's impossible. Thank you. Yeah?
What came up with me is that in terms of right and wrong and
doing it the same way. It's like scientific inquiry. A lot of the breakthroughs came through mistakes. Mm-hmm. That they didn't do it the way they were supposed to. Something happened. So what happened? Yeah.
Yeah, right. Isn't that how antibiotics were discovered? I think so.
In terms of the brain mold or something.
Yeah. I mean, thank goodness, right? But it was an accident. I can't remember the story.
It was penicillin,
the first antibiotic. How amazing, right? So we just, unexpected consequences.
Well, and I think as we move in our life, we have these decision points and we want to make sure to make the right decision, right? And there's this image that if I make the right decision, that will lead to where I want to go. And if I don't, that's bad. And it reminds me of one of my favorite stories was I was riding my mountain bike with a friend, and he took me on a new trail through the woods. And I went with him, I think, twice, and then went back by myself a couple days later and came to a fork in the road that I hadn't remembered in the path. But I sort of centered in, you know, took a breath, and then it just felt like that was the way to go, the left. So I went left, and there were two more turns. And each time I really looked inward, you know, here. And it was correct, so I got to the end. But I went back several more times on that trail and took the other turns, and they all led to the end. So they were exactly equal. But I was quite proud of myself for having discerned the correct path. And I think our life is much more like that. Mistake, not mistake. Those are irrelevant concepts when we really look at life itself. There is only one world.
You know, it reminds me of the Robert Frost poem, Two Roads Diverged in the Yellowwood. And I once heard Robert Frost interviewed towards the end of his life, and you know, people said, "Oh, that poem, you know, changed my life." And I took the road less traveled. That's what it's called, the road less traveled. I took the road less traveled, you know, and that's made all the difference. And he said, no, wait, that's not what that poem's about. He said, that was a quotation at the end. My younger self deludedly thinking that taking this path made all the difference. He said, it doesn't make any difference. You know, it's just like this story. You will get to wherever you're going. It doesn't matter. And I couldn't even make sense of that when I heard him say it, because I'd been so locked into, I know what this poem is about. It's about choosing, you know, the Thoreau version of life, right? He said, no, that's not what I meant. And then when I looked at it on paper, it's a quote. He's quoting himself as a young man, foolishly thinking this will make a difference. I love that. I just love that. So here we are, right? Yeah. Did you have your hand up?
I particularly like the idea that both the ox and the cow are equally valid and, you know, valuable beings. And I keep on thinking of that with all of the comparisons and the getting it right, getting it wrong, that, you know, that it's okay to get it wrong and to be the being that gets it wrong in the world, you know. You're still, you still have that light or that Buddha nature. And I just think that's so important, you know. I keep coming back to that. I appreciate that.
Yeah, we live in this world where it's so everything is graded, and everything as well as this better or worse, and this absolute quality of success, failure, looking good, looking bad, some great freedom of everything shining with its own light,
And part of our job as practitioners is to see that, to see everyone as the Buddha, everything we encounter, it's a quite a different world when we open our eyes in that way. Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay. What, to me, comes down to very simply is that I don't want to suffer. I don't want to feel the pain of what happens to me when I make a wrong choice. Mm. Then I feel bad. Then I feel these feelings that I really don't want to feel. Right? So, it's good to have rules. So if I follow the rules, then I won't feel bad. I will say the rule. You know, it served as my guide. And I followed the rules, so it's nothing. I don't have to feel bad. I don't have to feel I hurt somebody's feelings. I'm like, you know, it's all done for me. It's all laid out for me. I just follow the rules. And to really be able to look at everything and not just, you know, right or wrong, just be able to look at it, is taking it deeper, to be willing to look at what is this pain, what is this suffering, what is it that I'm avoiding by playing according to all the rules, you know, what am I avoiding? I find that it's hard to do that. I mean, it's rewarding, but I'm so trained to follow the rules, and so we do it without even thinking of it. And so, you know, but that's what comes up for me about this stuff.
I love that. Being good girls and boys is kind of designed to avoid suffering, but we can't avoid suffering. So it's a huge delusion, and yet it was inculcated into us as children. You know, if you do the right thing, if you please mommy and daddy, or you know whatever, or your teachers, or we suffered anyway. It's kind of funny, you know, and we continue to suffer. But when, as you were talking, I was, you know, really going with you, a sympathetic vibration with that. And for myself, that fear, it's not even the suffering I'm trying to avoid. There's a fear, right, of the suffering that's like, oh my God. And when I don't have it, there's a certain point when the mistakes accumulate, I'm talking about myself, like so many mistakes, you know, that I can't, it just topples over. And there's a release, you know, where the fear goes away. Like I can't get criticized anymore. You know, I've reached some limit. It's really liberating. And, you know, this is one of the lines that I've discovered this year. We used to talk about how Suzuki Roshi, Shinryu Suzuki from San Francisco Zen Center, used to say that life is one continuous mistake. And it turns out he was quoting Dogen. And I tried to find the quote, and it doesn't actually say anywhere Dogen said it's one continuous mistake. That was Suzuki's translation from Japanese to English, to his own sense of English. But what one translator says is Dogen said, if you step forward, it's a mistake. If you step backward, it's a mistake. If you stay where you are, it's a mistake. And I think that's the spirit of one continuous mistake, or one mistake after another. Because we just never have enough information. Once we know that, though, once we know it's all going to be screw-ups, then there's a lightness, there's a quality I don't know, it feels very free to me. And it's a rare thing for me to experience, but when it does arise, it's like, phew, all right, who cares? Yeah, it's just, how could it get any worse? You know, hot enough for you?
Well, yeah, and on the other side, you quote a friend of yours who says, if you're out walking, never say you can't get wetter.
Oh, right. That's true.
So, the other side of this is that we are responsible for the consequences of our actions. Or we're responsible for meeting what arises. So we can say, you know, there's not right and there's not wrong, but our actions have impact in the world. And I think our Zen way is to work with the impact we make in the world. Sometimes our impact is unintended. In fact, most of the time it is. But can we meet the feedback we get not as so personal? Because usually it's, oh, I'm a bad person, which actually means that I can't respond to what's going on because I'm really just more concerned about trying to look good or trying, you know, Ray, what you said about avoiding those feelings. Like, oh, I just don't want to feel like that. So I'll ignore it or pass over it. But there is this freedom of action that, that you're talking about that I think is so important when we act from the deepest place we know, realizing that it'll be right and it'll be wrong. But we can act in freedom that way and then meet what arises. And if we hurt someone's feelings or if someone's angry, that's not a problem. It's like, wow, so there's that. What's to be learned? How can I be more skillful? What's happening in this situation? But the little self, I remember the book of Inner Tennis, and this guy was talking about how when you hit the ball and it goes the wrong direction, if you criticize yourself, you go, oh shoot, you can't really learn how to play tennis. Because then it's about you criticizing yourself and the body. So when you hit it over the fence, you really got to hit it over the fence. Oh, that's what it feels like to hit it over the fence. And next time, maybe a different way. But that cringe of, oh, I'm terrible, really diminishes the freedom in the next moment. So how do I meet what's here and work skillfully with this?
Well, and I think, too, a third side to this is that when the cringe happens, when we do take it personally, if we try to say to ourselves, oh, just don't take it personally, then that's in the rule list again.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
So we have to actually start where we are. We have to start with taking it personally, feeling the cringe. Your teacher, your second teacher, George Bowman, your transmitting teacher, said that many times. You know, that feel the cringe. I always remember that. And that really deep feeling of it allows the transformation to occur, right? But if you just say, oh no, it's not personal. This is just universal human beings being, no, it's got to start. Yep. Personally, so it's this, this wonderful thing.
Yeah.
Esther, did you have your hand?
It's about the storm.
The storm.
So I've been looking for the storm. In my country, a storm looks different. I'm looking out the window, seeing the storm, and even thinking of contacting people in case I can't fly out tomorrow. And so this morning in the silence, I had a most interesting experience of not knowing, like literally not knowing. There was a sound behind the house. And my mind, and it was a very direct experience of the mind trying to figure out what it was. And I thought it was someone stuck in a snow
bank
pile or something. So I sort of identified that. But then there's this wild sound. And images came up of something I saw when I was a little child of a tornado in Florida. That took these wooden houses and just took them on. And I was like, what is this? You know, what is the storm really like here? I don't know. And I kept listening in and out of the sound, and it was really, it just sounded like it came whopping up against the house side and then away again. Do they have wings that go like this? It's so sweet in a way to really, and also a bit embarrassing. I feel, you know, that mostly I know what's going on.
Yeah.
But this morning I did not know, and then finally I recognized the sound of tires on ice, and I was like, ah. I wonder if Ray is out clearing up. But, you know, the whole time I was, and there was fear. Mm-hmm. There was, came fear. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, I don't know what, you know, maybe, what else, what happens when there's this?
It was actually the man we paid to plow out the parking lot, and Ray did do more snow blowing, as we call it, later. But I when I heard that sound, I immediately knew what it was. You know, my little TikTok brain just said, "Oh, George is here plowing! Oh, fantastic! I love George!" And it was just this happy, joyous. I was just like, "Oh, there he is, coming down." So, same information.
Right.
And to really be open like that to what's arising.
And what also happened was there was a feeling of sympathetic, like some kind of compassion for if other people were in the room that didn't know the sound either.
Yeah.
They might be scared, too, coming from similar parts of the world.
Yeah.
So it was just
yeah.
a new experience.
Jenny, you just you had your hand up. Why don't we have one last?
A whole lot came up in your talk. I've been going to the grocery store the last few days, and I only had heard about the storm from you, but yeah, everybody in the grocery store, the clerks feel all overwhelmed. Everybody's there, and all the half and half is sold out. I was thinking about like cold enough for you, and it's really, it's kind of this, it's this excitement. It's like, mm-hmm. We're in this together. Yeah. We're going to go through this thing together.
Yeah.
It's Sangha. Sangha power. That's what cold enough for you and hot enough for you is. Yes. Sangha power. How beautiful.
The other thing with the folding up the blinds, I thought there was this, we used to get this children's magazine and it had a cartoon, Goofus and Gallant. They were these twin brothers and Goofus did everything wrong and Gallant did everything right, and it was supposed to teach you, you know, how to behave, but like I just got a different message. Why would their parents do that to them? Yeah. I set up this situation.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah. Well, perfect way to end. Goofus and Gallant, the ox and the cow. So let's come back into our upright sitting posture.